Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring podcasts on the Blue Wire Network. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System yet, then you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. Wherever you are across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's Unified, U-N-I-F-Y-D, healing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.
What kind of mythical powers does a Sun Devil have? We've got to consider that.
It's embarrassing, but we are who we are. We're not a very good team, but we're 3-1 somehow. And we got all the voters fooled, thinking we're pretty good.
Jaworski Lane at 275 pounds showed a heck of a lot of athletic ability.
Welcome to a conference championship weekend preview edition of the RotoWire College Football Podcast, the Mike Teal of College Football Podcast. Nick Whalen joined, as always, by RotoWire head honcho of college football content, John McKechnie, who is listed on my StreamYard screen right now as Cade McNown. I got to admit, John, I've kind of consider myself a maestro of alma maters when it comes to football and basketball, especially. I don't know where Cade McNown went to college.
You know that, yeah, this is deeper back than we usually go. You know, usually our sweet spot is anywhere from like when we were in sixth grade onward. This was way before then. This was Cade McNown is like the first person I remember being like a big draft bust. And specifically, I just remember mostly there was like a very famous picture of him at UCLA. I remember you used to get Sports Illustrated when they used to print that thing and read it. Yeah. There is a great picture of him, shall we say, losing his lunch. And that picture has stuck with me to the point where I even wanted to have that as my display name on StreamYard 20 plus years after the fact. It's a lasting image for me. It's an important image. And, I just wanted to pay some reverence to him, even though UCLA is not playing this weekend.
You know, I'm surprised a photo like that would make it to print. I don't know if they would do that anymore, you know, especially with like the potential link to like a concussion or something like that. I just don't know that in the year of our Lord 2021, I don't know if someone is losing their lunch in print these days.
But you know what? There's something to be said for the slapstick humor that was appropriately appreciated in the late 90s, including a college guy ralphing on the field and having it be caught in sterling refinement.
I'll have to have our producer bleep your use of the R word there, ralphing. Ralphing is not said very often in Wisconsin. I don't know if that's like a Southern thing or a Maryland thing. Now and then. I know what it means. I grew up with nobody who ever used the word ralphing.
I had like a buddy in high school that like, yeah, his that was his go-to word for it. And if someone did lose their lunch at a party or something unrelated to anything, this one kid eventually like got the full nickname. Like he just got called Ralph for like the rest of high school for that reason. His name is not Ralph.
Curious about a Ralphing to get the nickname Ralph.
Yeah, he built himself quite the reputation.
Oh man. All right. So first things first, I want to spend the next probably 15 to 20 minutes talking about our Spotify Wrapped for the year 2021. No, just kidding. I actually have no interest whatsoever in hearing about anybody's Spotify Wrapped. Although you and I did cover that with some input from our buddy Chris Owen on Twitter yesterday. Shout out to Godsmack for making it into the top 100 for both of us. But
yeah,
I want to start with some of the coaching carousel madness that continues to transpire this week. And we went pretty deep on the Lincoln Riley to USC situation on Monday in our kind of weekend recap episode. And about 2 hours after we posted that, all of a sudden we get news that Brian Kelly's going to LSU. So we haven't had a chance really to break that down. Obviously, it's been covered pretty extensively, elsewhere on the internet and on other podcasts. So I don't think we're going to be breaking any news here, but we do have news, over the last 24 hours or so that defensive coordinator Marcus Freeman set to take over at LSU. It kind of felt like right after Brian Kelly, and we're being generous by using the word announced, Brian Kelly kind of scampered down to LSU, that instantly everybody's like, all right, it's either Urban Meyer is leaving the Jags for Notre Dame. I was crossing my fingers for that scenario. That's not going to happen. The more likely scenario was that Luke Fickell finishes things up. If Notre Dame is willing to wait, that's the obvious move. Luke Fickell hired from Cincinnati to Notre Dame, an obvious, one step to another. And, now it looks like Notre Dame wasn't willing to wait.
Exactly. So yeah, the Monday was nuts because, like you said, we finished recording, check Twitter. Brian Kelly's like the number one trend and, we're off. And, he's caught plenty of flack, deserved for the most part, throughout the week for the way in which he left. But the way I feel about breakups in general, in life or in college football is like, there's no great way to do. I don't know what Brian Kelly's supposed to do. Like, by the time that he's down in Baton Rouge accepting the job, it's getting leaked out that he's taking it. Like, before he even gets on the plane to go back to South Bend, like, his players know. So it's just like, the way that information spreads so quickly now, it was kind of inevitable that this would happen. And I understand that the players being upset and they're not being a whole lot of warmth in that Tuesday 7 a.m. Hey, I'm rolling out meeting, but I think a lot of it is a little bit of a function of the public just not really liking Brian Kelly, and that's fine. I don't think he's the most likable guy in the world. So piling on him, I'm not going to throw my hands up and say, oh, he doesn't deserve any of this, but maybe it's a little bit overwrought. But I guess we'll talk about Notre Dame first. They're in a tricky position. I was talking to a buddy of mine, big Notre Dame guy. On Monday, I was like, it's got to be Fickell, right? And he was like, well, Freeman has been the understanding that I have is that Freeman kind of a handshake deal to be that coach in waiting at Notre Dame. But I don't think that the accelerated timeline was expected. I think that this was something where Notre Dame fans felt that Kelly would be there till probably like the middle part of this decade and then step away and Freeman would take over. I don't think that anyone expected it to be this quickly. Freeman just got that job this past offseason. But when you have this tricky line that you're walking, there's so much intrigue because, you're going after a guy like Luke Fickell potentially, but his team is ranked in the playoff. You lost to that team, but you're still in playoff contention, but you just lost your coach. Like, how do you juggle all of those factors? And at a certain point, maybe they got it. Maybe they kicked the tires on Fickell, or maybe they just kind of had to make the snap call and be like, we don't have a lot of time here. There's still a chance, a snowball's chance in hell at the very least that we're going to be able to get into the playoff. Continuity would certainly help us. And the committee talked about that on Tuesday. We factor in coaching changes, blah, blah, blah. They just kind of like farted that out there. But either way, I think Freeman stands as a good hire for Notre Dame. If he was going to be the coach in waiting eventually anyway, like, why not now? And it, it feels like this breathes some life into Notre Dame even a little bit more. And they've done really well this season, I think. So he's there. You got Tommy Rees staying and doing the classic Wolf of Wall Street, I'm not leaving tweet. No matter how many times people do that one, I always love it. It just always
hasn't gotten old at all.
Yeah, it's crazy how that one like has such a good shelf life. But either way, I think that this, regardless of whether Notre Dame ends up making the playoffs, I think Notre Dame fans have to be happy with the way this week unfolded. I think a lot of them were kind of tired of Brian Kelly. I think a lot of them knew that Freeman could be that next guy. I think that there might be a little bit of a sting that it's not Fickell. But if Freeman was going to be the guy eventually, or you had to make that choice and ultimately lose Freeman by bringing in Fickell, I think all told, this worked out really well for Notre Dame.
Yeah, and you're hiring a 35-year-old. So, ostensibly, this is someone, not that Luke Fickell is a whole lot older, but, this is someone who you view as, if things go right through these first few years, maybe a, long, long-term type of fit at Notre Dame. And, you read that the players really wanted Freeman to get this job. And I think that maybe had something to do with it, but obviously you have to act fast, you know, and I think the concern is that if Luke Fickell, you know, wins this weekend and things break right for Cincinnati, you know, you maybe are waiting until all the way to the end of the college football playoff, which, as we know, you know, there's always that long break between this weekend and when the playoff starts. And, you know, I mean, certainly coaches have accepted jobs and, you know, coached through that. And it can kind of be a distraction. I don't know if Luke Fickell maybe indicated that he didn't want to do that. But essentially, Notre Dame, I think, just did not want to take that risk of, you know, losing out on their own guy in-house over these next few weeks. And I think there's kind of a general sense of optimism, right? It doesn't feel like there's some sort of letdown that they didn't get a bigger name guy.
No, I really do feel like this worked out a kind of best case scenario for Notre Dame, especially considering the fact that playing that game of chicken, waiting the full month, putting Cincinnati and Fickell in that awkward spot where, you know, you know the way that the news cycles work, the festering kind of underlying, oh, Fickell's going to be coaching in the playoff, but it, you know, he's half of his heart is in South Bend right now. He's not really focused. You know, that would have just festered over the course of the month, because like you said, this is such a long layoff from conference championship weekend until the college football playoff on New Year's Eve. So this was something where I think ultimately just expediting this process and going with what you had in-house already when he was, you know, a promising up and coming type of guy to begin with, this really sets up nicely for Notre Dame. It does make me wonder, because it was one of the few, I feel like Fickell, for among those hot names, there aren't that many landing spots that I think a lot of people project him to. There aren't that many huge jobs in the Midwest that are going to be opening anytime soon. Ryan Day is obviously doing an awesome job at Ohio State. Harbaugh safe at Michigan, of course, after this past week. Mel Tucker going to be at Michigan State until they run out of money, it seems like. So, you know, with Notre Dame off the table, it does kind of reset the Fickell watch as far as where he goes after Cincinnati, because there's been so much made of him just being like the consummate Midwest guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it might be another year of waiting for Fickell, and we'll see what goes on there. Obviously, Cincinnati going to do whatever they can to keep him, but you're right, there's not really another obvious pivot right now with the Notre Dame job, you know, seemingly going to Freeman. Let's talk about Brian Kelly's fit at LSU. I am not optimistic about this. I mean, at the same time, he is the winningest coach in Notre Dame history. I think from a pure coaching perspective, there's a pretty high floor here. Like, I don't see this turning out to be a complete disaster where all of a sudden LSU is going like 2-9 in a couple of years. Like, I think he's a good enough coach and a good enough, you know, like program CEO type of guy, even though he could be a little bit abrasive or a lot of it abrasive, that I do think it's a relatively safe hire. But I mean, at the same time, like everything we know about Brian Kelly versus everything we know about the LSU program, like it just seems like a really, really odd match to me.
So I had the privilege of every Tuesday I go on the radio with the sports company down in Ruston, Louisiana. So that's some boots on the ground folks. And you know, they picked my brain about it on Tuesday, and I picked their brain about it. And I think the big kind of knee-jerk reaction that anyone would have to this is like, you know, Brian Kelly, a Notre Dame man going to LSU, that is just on its surface a strange cultural fit. There's no way around it. And I think that LSU, like there's cultural fit of like being in the South. And then like LSU, I feel like is a job that like takes it to another level. And they're obviously coming off of moving away from the guy who was the greatest cultural fit that LSU possibly could have had in Coach Ed Orgeron, but it didn't work out. And then you look at the two coaches that preceded him are Midwest guys. I mean, Saban came down from Michigan State, and Les Miles, famously a Michigan man. So, you know, there's chances that the carpetbagging Northerners can actually have success down in the South and down in Louisiana. You hope that it doesn't end the same way that like Joe Moorhead's run at Miss State did. I don't think it will. I think that, you know, the resumes simply aren't comparable from where Moorhead was coming from in his career versus Kelly being the winningest coach at Notre Dame. So once you get beyond that, you do kind of wonder, there are things at LSU from a recruiting angle that I think could set this up really nicely. As long as Kelly is able to do this, this sets up well, because Notre Dame, there are hurdles to getting guys to go to Notre Dame. You got to have that full buy-in. You got to have the academics up to a certain standard that's a little bit tougher. I'm not even bagging on LSU. It's just Notre Dame. It's hard to pull some of these guys. And it's also a little bit of a tougher sell to get a kid to South Bend. You know, Kelly did well with guys in Vegas and stuff like that, getting some West Coast guys to buy in and come to South Bend, Indiana. I think that this could just turn on, another faucet as far as his recruiting chops go. And, you know, if he's able to build that or can maintain the wall that LSU tends to have in the state of Louisiana, where it's you're up against it in terms of pulling a blue chip type of talent away from the state, then, you know, we could have these really, really talented teams. I'm interested to see who his coordinator hires are going to be, because obviously Reese and Freeman staying back in South Bend. So as long as he gets those hires right, this could, you know, be a good hire for LSU, despite the kind of weird aesthetics of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's just so easy to picture like Brian Kelly like awkwardly entering the home of a recruit from like, you know, the down fingers of Louisiana in the deep South, and it's like, I just don't know how this guy's going to handle this. And he'll probably do a lot better than all the jokes on Twitter the last week have implied. But it's definitely going to be like you mentioned with Coach O, it's a complete opposite direction, right? And the Coach O thing worked really well for 1 year and really badly for another year. And it's, you know, kind of comes out neutral overall. I wonder if that was an intentional decision by LSU to go in that opposite direction and go with a guy who, you know, Coach O was such a culture fit, and Brian Kelly on the outside is such a non-culture fit. I do wonder if that was an intentional move to kind of try to separate themselves a little bit from how the Coach O era ended.
Yeah, that definitely would make sense. And I think that there are a lot of signs that point to that maybe factoring into this process. And, you know, again, neither of us are huge Brian Kelly guys. I don't know a single huge Brian Kelly guy, but you can't really argue with the results that he's had at Notre Dame and LSU. Again, the recruiting barriers there don't exist the same way they do in South Bend. So I think that this could work out extremely well. We'll see how it goes. I think overall, I give LSU like a B+, A- for this one. And I think Notre Dame probably deserves an A-, but that there's a little bit more unknown when it comes to Freeman. But when you're betting on a guy who's been hot defensive coordinator for years, and he's 35. He's really personable. Gonna be able to connect with the players in a certain way that maybe Kelly wasn't. Then, you know, I think this should set up well for both programs. So I think it ended up, when the dust settles, it ends up being a win-win for both.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, obviously a lot of momentum for Notre Dame these last few years. You don't really want to lose that. I think keeping the hire in-house, at least on paper, should help accomplish that. Let's turn to the games this weekend. We have a fantastic conference championship weekend ahead of us. And I mean, not every game has like, you know, football or college football playoff implications, but more than normal, it feels like do. You know, I mean, you have Baylor, Oklahoma State. There are routes that either of these teams could potentially end up in the playoff. Obviously, Georgia, Alabama, massive implications. Houston, Cincinnati, huge implications there for one of those teams. Michigan, Iowa. I mean, there's going to be a lot going on, and you could kind of scheme out so many different ways that these games play out. And all of a sudden teams like Notre Dame are very much in the mix to make the playoff. But we'll start on Friday night with two teams that are likely still on the outside looking in. I mean, I don't know if Oregon would need an insane amount of help to somehow end up in the playoff, but they sit at 10-2, of course, lost to Utah, who they will face in Vegas on Friday night. They lost to Utah 38-7 2 weeks ago. And, you know, of course, Utah, a 2.5-point favorite in this game, which I think makes sense. Although, you know, based on the beatdown that Utah put on Oregon 2 weeks ago, I wouldn't be shocked if this number was a little bit higher.
Yeah, I mean, that would make sense given how thorough a dismantling that. I mean, like, it wasn't just that Utah put a big number on the board. It was that Oregon simply couldn't do anything on offense. And of course, their defense got completely kind of just bullied around, which is how they had kind of gotten to that point in the season. But we had the smell out for that Utah upset a few weeks ago in Salt Lake City. I'm going to flip-flop here. I think Oregon wins. I think that this is the second time that they match up in as many weeks. I think Oregon still on balance, the more talented roster. They obviously have the bad taste in their mouth after that game a couple weeks back, neutral site. So they don't have quite the hostile environment that they'll be walking into. Are Utah people afraid of Las Vegas? No, I'm kidding. I just think that Oregon should be able to get it done here. I think this is going to be a really, really close game. SP Plus has Utah winning this one by less than a full point as far as its projected margin is concerned. So that goes to show you how even that this matchup is. That they play very similar styles. Don't ask their quarterbacks to do a lot. Lean on the run game and good defense. But I'm just going to kind of defer to the old adage about it, how difficult it is to beat a team twice, especially in a two-week span. I do think that Oregon, on balance, is a more talented team. So I'm going to side with Oregon here.
I like it. Very tough to beat a team twice. I've heard a lot of people say that. I mean, who knows how true it actually is, but it seems like it'd be true. And, you know, we don't have a whole lot else to go on here. Other than the result, you know, 2 weeks ago. And I don't think Utah stomps them again. I think that would be probably the most surprising result if it's another resounding victory for Utah. And we should know there's nothing on the line here. I mean, again, the chances of either of these teams having a true case for the playoff is basically zero. But the winner likely goes to the Rose Bowl, which still means something, even in the playoff era, especially for teams that aren't always there. Still a decent amount of meaning in that game on Friday night. Saturday morning, we kick things off in a hurry. 11 a.m. Central, 12 Eastern, we get the Big 12 championship game, Baylor and Oklahoma State. Oklahoma State, a 5.5-point favorite in this one. There's still a path for Baylor to get into the playoff. There's definitely a path for Oklahoma State to get into the playoff. My question, John, is if Oklahoma State wins, if Cincinnati wins, if Michigan wins, and if Georgia wins, does that put Oklahoma State in very solidly as the fourth team, or do we get an argument of, you know, two loss Alabama versus one loss Oklahoma State or even undefeated Cincinnati?
I think it would be a joke for two loss Alabama to get in over one loss conference champion Oklahoma State. And, you know, this isn't through red and black glasses. This is just a legitimate resume consideration. I think Oklahoma State's resume is extremely impressive. Their win over Oklahoma last week, really, really strong. They've obviously played Baylor earlier this season. I think that Oklahoma State would be a deserving, you know, number three or number four, however that the committee would want to seed that out in that particular circumstance, or in that if things were to play out that exact way. I just don't think that I know a lot has been made of Alabama. What if they lose close to Georgia? I don't know if they've built that, or if they deserve to have built that same cachet where they do something that no other playoff team has done yet and lose two games and still get in. Like, I don't think that they've really passed the eye test to that extent. I mean, when's the last time that they had a truly dominant win over an SEC team that really kind of made the statement? I think you have to go all the way back to the Ole Miss game, because, you know, you struggle against Arkansas, you struggle against Auburn. You kind of need a miracle to avoid that second loss on the Plains. Struggle against a bad LSU team. You lose to A&M that also lost to LSU. I don't think it's there if Alabama loses again, even if it is close. So I think that if Oklahoma State takes care of business and Georgia wins, then Oklahoma State's in.
Yeah, I think so too. And I don't even know if it matters how Alabama loses, if that's the scenario, you know, if they lose 33-30 or 38-7. I think two losses, you know, with one of those coming to A&M and then one coming to Georgia, they're not bad losses, obviously, but two losses, even though it's Alabama, even though, you know, the committee, I wouldn't say it's showing bias, but it has certainly given the Crimson Tide the benefit of the doubt in years past. I don't see that happening, you know, especially if it's a convincing win for Oklahoma State. And, you know, I mean, I think Oklahoma State, it's not like this is going to be their only ranked win, you know, like the resume isn't like extremely impressive, but it's still like a B plus resume. I don't know. I think some people are talking about Oklahoma State like it's a Cincinnati situation and they only have like one good win. I think they would be pretty safely in if they're able to pull this off.
Yeah, I think so too. Again, Bama is the looming factor there. If Georgia is to lose to Alabama, I imagine they both get in. We'll get to it, of course, but I think Michigan wins this weekend as well. So then it becomes the debate of theoretically an undefeated Cincinnati versus a one-loss Big 12 champ. It seems like the committee has positioned itself to just lean Cincinnati in that particular case. But I think if Georgia is to beat Alabama, Oklahoma State takes care of business. That's it. I don't see Alabama with two losses. It'd be a joke for a two-loss team to be left or to get in over a one-loss conference champ.
If you're the committee, I think you're rooting hard for Georgia to just keep this thing rolling.
Make it easy.
I think that makes your job so much easier. I mean, it's an impossible choice. Would you feel that strongly about it? Like, let's say Oklahoma State and Cincinnati both win. You know, they both look fine. Alabama beats Georgia. Like, if you had to choose between those two, like, do you have a lean even right now?
I think it's probably Cincinnati. I think you reward the undefeated team, undefeated conference champ, even though they're not Power Five. They have a better top win than Oklahoma State would have at this juncture. I would put Cincinnati at four in that particular case. If the two SEC teams in Michigan are getting in, then I think Oklahoma State's in trouble.
It's so tough. I mean, Oklahoma State would have two wins over Baylor. They would have beaten Oklahoma, but that's basically it, you know, and you have some relatively unimpressive non-con wins early on, you know, that didn't exactly bolster that resume, but, you know, that was also 3 months ago and, you know, recency bias does tend to be a factor. I think picking Cincinnati is the path of less resistance in that scenario. You know, I think there are certainly people in Stillwater who would be very upset if the Cowboys are left out in favor of Cincinnati, but I feel like nationally it would be a much bigger story if Cincinnati was passed over than if Oklahoma State was passed over.
I think so too. And I think Cincinnati has, you know, the committee has positioned itself in a way to make it extremely difficult for a group of five team to get in. Mm-hmm. And at this point, Cincinnati would have done basically everything to jump through those hoops. I mean, dating back to last season and being great, taking Georgia to the last second in the Peach Bowl in a New Year's Six bowl game, and then running the table this year. Like, what more can they do, especially if they haven't said directly that group of five teams can't get in?
Right. And you've said it before on this pod that you need kind of a 2 year run up. You know, you can't just come out of nowhere because you're starting in too big of a hole. And Cincinnati got this train rolling last year and they've rolled over perfectly. You know, there's not much more that you could ask the Bearcats to do. And that includes beating, you know, a top 25 team in Houston. It's not like they're playing some 6-6 team for the AAC title. I mean, this is a legitimate opponent in Houston.
Yeah, Houston, I think, has won 11 straight. Like, they're hot, and they're good, too. I mean, that's actually going to be a very good game. I know that it's going up against the SEC championship game, but keep an eye on that one. I feel like that's going to be a worthy second TV game to be having on there, because Houston's no joke, and they're red hot right now. If they're healthy, I think they'll give Cincinnati a test, but I do like Cincinnati to win that one.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to find a lot of people picking against Cincinnati or even rooting against Cincinnati. You know, unless you're an Oklahoma State fan or maybe a Notre Dame fan, who in their right mind doesn't want to see Cincinnati pull this thing off?
Exactly, dude. Like, what a fun story. They've been awesome for a couple of years, like we've said, and I think they've earned it. You know, this is a team. By group of five standards, it's well known by the public. I mean, you got Sauce Gardner, you got Desmond Ridder, you got Jerome Ford. Like, you kind of, by at least like serious college football fans, but if you're putting those parameters on there, like, the kind of household names, like those are dudes that you've known for a while and root for. It's not hard to root for the Cincinnati team.
No, not at all. I mean, it does kind of have that. It harkens back to like the 2007, 2008, like Boise State type of team. And that team felt like maybe even more of a Cinderella just because of how they played. Like, they were like noticeably undersized compared to the Power Five teams that they would play. And Cincinnati, I think, like, feels a little more legitimate than that Boise State team. But obviously, Boise State went and beat Oklahoma, so they were plenty legit themselves. Let's go back to Baylor, Oklahoma State. The Oklahoma State 5.5 point favorites in this one. Do you have a lean on how you see this one playing out?
So if Baylor's going to have a chance in this one, they need Gary Bohannon back there. I don't give them a whole lot of a chance if Sharpen's back there, or Blake Shapen, I'm sorry, instead of Gary Bohannon. Bohannon, of course, missed last week's game, and they kind of had to squeak it out against Texas Tech. So Bohannon's health is a huge factor in this game. I think that Oklahoma State, despite like you know, the proverbial like letdown spot. I don't think that happens in a conference championship game, especially with what's on the line for them. So even though they just beat Oklahoma, I think they're going to be laser focused this week. They haven't had as strong of a run game of late as they did earlier in the year. I don't know if there's something up with Jaylen Warren. He's still playing, but he's not as effective as he was earlier this season. So I just think that this comes down to Oklahoma State's defense just kind of choking out Baylor, keeping this low scoring. I mean, how often do we see a Big 12 title game have a total of just or of under 50, let alone under 47, like what we're seeing right now? So this is expected to be a defensive battle. I think Oklahoma State wins this one kind of ugly, but convincingly at the same time. Like the scoreboard would say it's ugly, but anyone who watched the game would say that Oklahoma State was in control throughout. So I'm seeing something like Oklahoma State 24, Baylor 13, something like that.
Again, in saying that, we're talking about a Big 12 game like that, and then a Big 12 game including these two teams, which have been like at the forefront of playing no defense for the last, Baylor especially is the team that I always just assume is like, oh, Bryce Petty has 8 touchdowns through 3 quarters. Again, here we go. What's going on with Gary Bohannon, by the way, who I think is technically kind of questionable heading into this one?
So he warmed up last week, but did not play. Were they saving him or was he legitimately unable to go? That I guess is the question that we'll never get the answer to. This is college football. Like they don't have to tell us anything about injuries, but I'm guessing that he's going to be able to go. I'm guessing that he's not going to be 100% though. I believe he's dealing with a hamstring.
That's what I'm seeing on this, some like niche website, rotowire.com that covers a lot of this injury news. I would recommend checking that out. Let's move to the afternoon. We mentioned Houston, Cincinnati. I think we both kind of are on the same page as far as how we feel that one will play out. But Georgia Bama is going to have the attention. And I know the SEC title game is always in the afternoon window. I definitely wish it was the nightcap. You know, Michigan-Iowa will be fun. Pitt-Wake will be fun. But this is the game I'm most excited for. And the Dogs are almost touchdown favorites, 6.5 points, which feels about right. Obviously, Alabama has not been super impressive. Major questions about how that offensive line will hold up against, you know, I think people are starting to contextualize, you know, this Georgia defense, just how good it is. But, you know, I think in the same way that we kind of looked back after LSU ran through everybody in the college football playoff and people started to question, like, is this one of, if not the most talented offenses we've ever seen? I think people are going to start, you know, lumping Georgia's defense into that conversation if they haven't already. And, you know, if they beat Alabama handily in this one, if they win by 2 or 3 touchdowns, if they hold Alabama to something like 14 points, I mean, that would just be yet another feather in the cap for the Dogs. And I can tell by the way you've been talking these last couple of weeks, I think you feel pretty confident about this, right? And you probably should.
I do. And first of all, I think it's a matter of public health and safety here in Atlanta that this game is played in the afternoon. I think if you made these fans wait until nighttime, it would just wouldn't go well for the entire city of Atlanta. But when it comes to this game, yeah, I'm concerned by how confident I am in this Georgia team. Yeah, I got asked on the radio earlier this week, you know, have you ever felt even mildly good about playing Alabama? And the answer was like a hard no. I mean, you know, I thought had a puncher's chance in the SEC championship in 2012. I thought they might get revenge in 2018 after the way the 17 game ended. When they played in 2015, that was just kind of like the beginning of the end for the Mark Richt era. I didn't really know how I felt about that one, but you know, it was pretty clear early on that Bama was just far more dominant. And I don't really consider last year's game much of anything, ironically, because Stetson Bennett was starting. But yeah, I think like you said in the preamble there, this Georgia defense is just crazy, and I think we're just starting to see week after week the way that they choke teams out. That like their points differential is like almost a full 400 over the course of the entire season. They've given up less than 100 points on the entire year. So much of their game time has been played in garbage time, just because they're up by so much, and yet they still don't let people score. It's just a crazy junkyard unit that's incredibly deep, incredibly talented, and incredibly well coached. And I think that we run into a situation this year where Alabama, unlike last year, where they had one of the best offensive lines maybe ever in college football, just unbelievably talented group that played together so well, gave Mac Jones all the time in the world that he wanted. That's not the case this year. Like we saw Auburn cave in that defense or offensive interior for Alabama. We saw A&M win on the strength of its ability to just knock Bryce Young around a little bit. And then they had to answer the bell in their own right. I don't think Georgia's going to keep Bama down for all four quarters. I think that last drive of regulation in the Iron Bowl is proof that you can be taking it to Bama's offense for 58 minutes, and they still have the talent to put a scoring drive together. So I think in the end, Georgia's defense is going to win more often than it's not. But I think that also it's going to have to find a way to effectively defend Bryce Young, putting it in the air upwards of 40 times, because I don't think that Alabama is going to run the ball at all. And whether that means that Georgia is just bringing a ton of pressure off the edge and just kind of blitzing with impunity, whether that rattles Bryce Young or not, we'll have to see. He's going to get knocked around a lot, though. I do feel, if you're Georgia, you almost want Alabama to have a slightly healthier run game because having to defend that much Bryce Young, I think, is going to be exhausting over the course of 60 minutes. And then on Georgia's offensive side, we're into December, and I still don't really know what to make of this offense. I still don't know what to make of Stetson Bennett. One thing I will point out is there have been so many times this year where he's bailed on a play and ran for it and gotten crushed from behind, but he's held onto the ball pretty much every single time. Fumbles haven't been an issue for him. I do wonder if that regresses to a norm here and Bennett does have a killer turnover. But if Georgia is able to do its part on defense and do its part in not turning the ball over to Alabama, and they obviously have to stop Will Anderson, of course, as well, then I think Georgia wins this one rather comfortably. But if those conditions aren't met, then we got a serious ball game on our hands and one that I think Alabama could win.
Yeah, I mean, Alabama could always win this game. And it's actually crazy that you and Georgia Nation is rightfully this confident, because the talent gap is not as big as like this spread would imply. You know, I mean, even just like comparing Georgia last year to where you are now is crazy. And it's not like Alabama's played poorly. That's not even really a factor in this. It's like Georgia's been that good. Georgia has earned being a touchdown favorite over Alabama in the SEC title game. In what's still been a really good year for Alabama, that's lost one game in a close one against Texas A&M. I mean, it just speaks to how dominant the Dogs have been. But I think you're spot on in terms of how this game script plays out for Alabama. I think you almost are under like an obligation to try to establish the run. I think, you know, we probably see like the first snap of the game is like a 2-yard loss where the running back is just hit like 3 yards behind the line. And then they could very quickly abandon that. And yeah, I think your fear, if you're a Georgia supporter here, is this turns into like kind of what we saw against Auburn, you know, from Alabama, or even A&M, Tennessee, Arkansas. Bryce Young had 40 plus attempts in all of those games. And when you have the receiving talent that they do, it's like, you know, if you're drawing pass interferences, if you let up a couple long ones, you know, all of a sudden the game is maybe a little bit closer than it ultimately should be based on, you know, the gap between these teams.
Yeah. I'm very interested to see because as good as Georgia's defense has been, I do feel like they haven't faced an offense this good or even really all that close. And I think the closest one would be Tennessee, and Tennessee moved the ball on Georgia. And obviously that game was in Knoxville. Tennessee's super up for that game, everything like that. But, I do wonder what Alabama and Bill O'Brien, I don't mean this to be like, oh, Bill, I'm terrified of what Bill O'Brien's going to scheme up here. But, you know, what does he take away from how Tennessee was successful and apply it here? Because there's clearly something that they were doing that was bothering Georgia. Although at the same time, Bama is not a tempo team and Tennessee runs warp speed. So would they completely change their offensive philosophy, or would they be able to in the span of 1 week? That's a question to consider. I don't know if they'd be able to pull it off 1-1. But yeah, maybe they do try to run a little bit of tempo here and get Georgia on their heels early in the game. And if Georgia is able to survive that script, how does the rest of the game go?
I tell you what, it's got to feel nice going into this game, which is one of the biggest games in Georgia history, certainly in recent Georgia history, knowing that even if there's some disaster scenario when you lose, you're still going to go to the college football playoff. Like, you're sitting in a great spot this weekend.
Yeah, 100%. So yeah, there's a little bit less pressure. Obviously, it gets ratcheted up if you do lose that game. Then you know, who do you draw in the first round of the playoff and so on. I would just prefer to get this over with. I'm so, as a Georgia fan, I've endured so much emotional damage from these people. I can't do it anymore. This needs to happen this weekend.
That's exactly how I felt.
Not even being professional about it. I'm just like, look, man, I'm tired.
Yeah. It's hard to even get excited for games. It's just like nerves. And just like, I just want this to be over. Sometimes I don't even care what the result is. I just want to deal with it. But yeah, we've both been put through the ringer. That is for certain this last decade. So we'll do picks at the end, but I think we'll both be siding with Georgia. I haven't quite decided yet if I think they'll cover this one. But again, we'll get that to the end. Michigan and Iowa in the the Big 10 title game in Indianapolis. This should have been Michigan-Wisconsin, setting up what would be a really fun game to watch. Wisconsin would probably lose again, but still would have been fun. Iowa comes into this now as 11-point dogs. And it's not like Iowa can't put up a fight. I think Iowa and Wisconsin, you know, probably line up as pretty similar opponents if you're Michigan. But the one thing for the Wolverines is you don't have that same luxury as Georgia. Like, you still need to win this game. I guess there are other scenarios where, you know, other teams could lose and you could still maybe back your way in. But winning this game is paramount. And for Michigan, it's all about just avoiding a letdown after a, you know, massively emotional win last week.
Right. So with that in mind, like, I could see Michigan starting this one slow. But you know, as we've talked about over the course of this season, when it comes to Iowa, they need to turn you over in order to really make you uncomfortable, because they're not really going to beat you straight up. Like, as long as you aren't making these colossal mistakes that flip the field or you know, result in a touchdown, that type of thing, then I think that this just straight up is a much better Michigan team than it is for Iowa. And you know, something that's a level of concern for Iowa in that sense is that Michigan ties for six in total turnovers this season. They've only given the ball away 9 times over the course of the entire season, and while they've also turned people over 15 times by their own right. So I think as long as Michigan plays to type, this is a really good setup for them. And Iowa always has a good offensive line. Linderbaum is like a legend. I think he's like PFF's highest graded center ever, but that he doesn't get to block Aiden Hutchinson. And that's a problem, because Hutchinson, as we've talked about over and over again, is a game wrecker. He can be kind of like the difference in a game in a way. So basically the way I see this one going is a low scoring, you know, playing to type of Big Ten championship game, that the kind that you would expect when these two teams are playing. I think that Michigan, you know, pounds Iowa on the ground and stops Iowa's run game. I think they get Spencer Petras or Padilla flustered, and I think Michigan wins this one like 24-10, but it's like a really loud 24-10.
It's not going to be easy. It's Michigan, right? Like, we know for a fact they're not just going to cruise to like a 30-point win and everything's going to be fine. Like, they're going to make this difficult on themselves at some point. But I mean, there is a giant upswell of optimism all of a sudden, you know, around this Michigan program. Like, it felt like they were always kind of lurking in the background, and obviously have had a good season, but like, nobody was talking about this team making the playoff until after the Ohio State win. Like, nobody was giving them a shot in that game. It was just assumed all year that they would get to that game and get blown out, and that would be it. And all of a sudden now it's kind of forced like an entire reevaluation, it feels like, of this team.
Even when they released the playoff rankings before the last week of the regular season, it, you know, it's like, oh yeah, there's a path to the playoff. They just have to beat Ohio State and win the Big Ten. They're not going to do either of those things. And they knocked down the first leg of that by beating Ohio State in you know, really impressive fashion. And now it's right there for them. It's almost like at the same time, I almost wonder if we as like the public were underestimating this Michigan team, especially because of maybe that Michigan State loss. Yeah. But that game is always funky. And Michigan State was a good team, at least at that point. So, I mean, that loss is, and it was on the road. So, I mean, somewhat forgivable, maybe a little bit less forgivable in hindsight. But them beating Ohio State is a definite statement that they're one of the best teams in the country. And I expect them to be able to take care of business here against Iowa.
All right. So going up against the Big Ten game, we do get the ACC championship game in the night window, Pitt and Wake. And we will use this as a smooth transition to talk about the DFS slate on DraftKings on Saturday. Kenny Pickett, the highest priced quarterback on the board. He's at 9,700. You got Sam Hartman on the other side of this game at 9,500. Ritter, the only other quarterback in the 9,000 range. He's at exactly 9,000 with Cincinnati, of course, going up against Houston. Are you looking to any of those three guys? Are you going a little bit cheaper at quarterback?
So, yeah, the DraftKings is definitely daring you to find a way to stack Pitt. And but what I mean by that is you got to pay, 19,000 of your $50,000 salary cap to stack Kenny Pickett and Jordan Addison. Mm-hmm. So that's a spicy meatball that you got to like account for with the rest of the way that you build out your lineup. You obviously have to pivot. You have to get some guys maybe under 4K. You might have to eschew going the 2QB route and use a position player in your super flex. You might have to go with somebody like a Stetson Bennett at 7,300 because the quarterback pricing makes it very difficult to find value. It feels like the one kind of maybe value guy with some upside is Clayton Toon, but Cincinnati's pass defense is so nasty that I do have my concerns about that in its own right. So I do feel like Kenny Pickett and the ACC championship game is kind of like the centerpiece of this Saturday main slate because that game is so high scoring. I mean, we're going to see a total in this one pushing for 70, and I don't think anything else really comes close on Saturday's slate as far as that's concerned. I don't think there's even anything. Oh, well, I guess the Maction game actually is pretty wild. So you got to keep Dustin Crum in mind, as you always do, of course. Especially that this week. But, you know, I think Pickett will just because the kind of lack of quarterback talent or good matchups, obvious good matchups on this slate, that Pickett is going to be the chalk for better or for worse. And it's just a way of finding out how to build a lineup around that. And I think if you use Pickett, you got to go with Addison. I just think that he eats up so many of those targets and he's so explosive that you got to go with him as well. So again, you really have to hunt value at other spots. I do think it's doable. But if you were to fade both Hartman and Pickett and yeah, by virtue of me not talking about Hartman, I'm not as on him this week as I am Pickett, you know, the $200 difference notwithstanding, I just think that Pickett has the better game in this one. Hartman does have a little bit of that rushing touchdown upside though. I think if you look down in that under 9K tier, I would consider Bryce Young. Again, you know, it's tough defense, but you never see Bryce Young down this far. And I think the game script sets up for a ton of passing attempts for him. So if he's pushing for 40 plus, I think that he's going to be able to probably return value on what's kind of a diminished price tag for him. Dustin Crum, again, 8,300. Then you're going to have to keep an eye on Rocky Lombardi on the other side of that MAC championship game. If he starts, then I like his chances of returning value at 7,500 as well.
Rocky Lombardi, all-time MAC name. Like that just so screams. Good. Everything about that screams MAC. Let's look at the running backs. Hassan Haskins coming off of that 5-touchdown game against Ohio State. By far the highest priced back on this slate. He's at 8,700. And then there's a massive drop off down to guys like Brian Robinson, Jerome Ford, Abram Smith in like the high 6,000, low 7,000. I mean, there's a $1,500 gap between Haskins and the next highest priced player. My question to you, I mean, if you're spending up at quarterback, obviously you're probably not going to roster Haskins, but if you're not spending up at quarterback, are you going to make that leap to a player who I assume will be pretty popular on the slate?
I'm going to try at least one lineup where I do eschew the top tier at quarterback and get a Haskins share. But some of the issue here with Haskins potentially is that Blake Corum is back. Like for the last couple of weeks of the regular season up until last weekend, you knew that you could bank on Haskins having like 25 plus carries. Obviously Haskins got fed again last week, but is Michigan going to feel as compelled to give him as many carries provided that Corum was able to perform so well on limited carries against Ohio State? So I expect like Haskins to push for around 25 carries, but I think that we're going to see Corum, who's down at just 4,300, draw a lot of interest as well, because if Corum gets double digit targets here, double digit carries, then I do like his chances of returning value as well. And again, if you have a quarterback heavy lineup build, I think Corum is a nice way of helping make that happen for you. fading Brian Robinson, and for the record, also very much fading Trey Sanders, the Bama backup running back who would presumably get the start in place of Robinson. I just don't like his chances of getting much going here either. So I'm going pretty cheap at running back. The highest priced running back that I went after in my kind of initial build is Alton McCaskill of Houston. I think if Houston tries to, you know, you got to choose the lesser of two evils when you're attacking Cincinnati's defense. I think you can have a little bit more success on the ground. So if McCaskill's good to go, which I believe he is, he's a freshman that scored, I think, 15 or 16 touchdowns this year on the ground. Really impressive stuff from him. I expect him to have a nice game there, especially at 6,300. But yeah, running back, generally, I'm going for value. I like James Cook at 5,500. I think that there's a non-zero chance that he actually has a bigger impact in this game than Zamir White does. I like Treston Ebner of Baylor. He got it going big time last week. If you used him in DFS, he had a really solid game. He can get it done both as a pass catcher and as a rusher, kind of a different change of pace guy to Abram Smith, the converted linebacker, who's just more of like a straight ahead hammer type of guy. On the Maction side of things, Clint Ratkovich, that guy just scores a lot of touchdowns is basically the main theory behind him. He has 11 touchdowns on the year. So basically he's their goal line guy, and they go to him without really thinking twice about it. They don't really go with Jay Ducker as much. Jay Ducker, 5,600. So he's, you know, reasonably priced. I think that there's a case to be made for him as well. But there's a little bit less touchdown upside, but that Ratkovich is risky because he doesn't get that many carries. Greg Bell, 5,200, also interesting. He's not that explosive, but San Diego State, I think, plays a control type of game, a lot of possession. And Greg Bell is kind of the main guy for them, and they're a little bit banged up at quarterback right now. So I think Bell is going to be a factor at 5,200 if they can get things going against Utah State's run defense. So I like that a little bit. And I would also keep an eye on the App State running backs. Cam Peoples is someone that I like a lot. He's down at 4,000, but you have some other guys in that App State backfield who are seeing some work of late. So I haven't given my final verdict on my article as for which App State guy I'm going to trust in the backfield, but I will have some exposure to it just because I'm going with a more quarterback and receiver heavy type of lineup build. So I need to find value at running back. And I think App State presents a decent way, especially with Billy Napier on his way out the door.
So at receiver, you mentioned Jordan Addison, who has 6 touchdowns and almost 300 yards on 25 catches over his last 2 games. That included a 61.2 DraftKings point game against Virginia in week 12. 14 catches, 202, and 4 touchdowns in that one. So he's kind of on a tier of his own at 9,300. You mentioned, you know, potentially stacking him with Kenny Pickett. You got Jamison Williams, the Ohio State transfer at Alabama. He's at 8,000. A.T. Perry at Wake, Devin Tompkins, Tay Martin, John Mechie, the list goes on. Even Brock Bowers, you know, touchdown machine these last 2 weeks, he's down at 6,700. Where do you lean at the receiver position?
Yeah, there's so many ways to go with this one. So I really like how the board sets up for that. I think specifically as far as like the game theory is concerned, because when you see Jamison Williams that high up, I feel like that's always a sign for people to just go, oh, I'm going to do John Mechie instead. Like they always just like try to save a little bit of coin. But I think that Williams is the more explosive player between himself and Mechie. I think he's the one that gives Georgia a little bit more of a matchup problem. So especially if you're considering Bryce Young, I think you have to have Jamison Williams in your lineup. Really like him. A.T. Perry, he's been amazing this year, kind of emerged as that number one guy in the Wake Forest offense. The DFS heads will appreciate the tweet I had a few weeks ago where I'm like, A.T. Perry is who we thought Scotty Washington was going to be, another like 6'5 Wake receiver from a couple years ago. That was back when I forget the name of the guy that transferred to Georgia, the Wake Forest quarterback, but those two had quite a connection many moons ago. But I digress. Devin Tompkins, he is literally like my size. He is not a large man, but he is near the top of the FBS in receiving yards. San Diego State, obviously a tough test. And I just worry that they're going to slow the game down. San Diego State is to the point where Utah State's output and play volume might take a bit of a hit here. And Utah State's other receivers have started to kind of ascend as legitimate weapons alongside him. They don't only have to go to Devin Tompkins, so I'm a little bit worried about him this week. Dante Cephas of Kent State, if you want to go with that Dustin Crum, I think that he's the obvious guy that you pair with him. Trayvon Rudolph, the guy who had the legendary Maction performance with like 300 receiving yards a few weeks ago, he's down at 7K or 6,900 against Kent State. Maybe something to consider there. I do like Brock Bowers. I think that he's the best pass catching option that Georgia has as a true freshman tight end, which is just kind of unbelievable. But that dude is just built different. He's crazy. I really like Jermaine Burton, though, if you're going for some more Georgia receiving exposure. I still don't think, even though Pickens is going to play, I still don't think that he's going to see an appreciable amount of snaps to really make it worth it, even though he's down at min price. So maybe if you need the min price guy, go Pickens. But 4,700 for Burton, I think, is a really, really nice deal. I think that we're going to see him be as involved as he's been all season, because A.D. Mitchell, Kyaris Jackson aren't really getting it done on the outside for the Bulldogs in the passing game. So I think this is a big Brock Bowers and Jermaine Burton type of game. And then Jared Wayne, always like him just because of how banged up the rest of the non-Jordan Addison Pitt receivers are. So I would certainly take Jared Wayne into some consideration as well.
So I realized I was muted as I was like shouting this into the void. Jamie Newman.
Quarterback.
Yeah. I was like, why is he not reacting to this?
I'm just that stoic.
To be fair, it took me a couple seconds too. I was like, that was a pretty big deal at the time. And he just completely disappeared into thin air.
He did. I think he went undrafted and then practice squad and then free agent. So
yeah, kind of the same path as Kelly Bryant.
Yeah. Yeah. At least Bryant played though. But
yeah, it was actually pretty good.
No, he seriously was. But yeah, I don't wish any ill on Jamie Newman. Either way, had
it's
to throw
just a classic. It is what it is scenario.
It truly is what it is. And Nick, if you'll humor me for like 2 seconds, I'm going to just run through a quick thought on the Friday slate. Western Kentucky, UTSA, and then Oregon, Utah. I think you just have to eat the chalk here. I think you have to go with Frank Harris and Bailey Zapp as your quarterback and super flex, especially with Harris being 6,400. Jarrett Stearns has 170 targets this year. You can't fade him on DraftKings, in my opinion. But Western Kentucky has had some ascension from guys like Mitchell Tinsley of late to also consider, and he's pretty affordable at 6K. I think that if you're going running back, my move is to go with Sincere McCormick and Tavion Thomas. I'm not going after Travis Dye as much, despite my thoughts that Oregon might find a way to win this one. And then some value receivers, DeCorian Clark of UTSA. He's kind of the main guy, or like the third guy in that pass game rotation has started to pop up of late. And Chris Hudson of Oregon, 4,300. Also a guy to keep an eye on, 18 targets over the last 2 weeks.
All right. I love it. That's a deep dive for anybody playing that Friday slate. Let's make some picks. Let's get out of here, pal.
All right.
We'll start with Oregon and Utah. We'll hit the main slate here on Friday. Utah, -2.5 in this one. Again, you're going Oregon?
I'm going Oregon. So if I'm putting some shekels on it, I'm going Oregon money line.
Okay. Shekels is not a word that I was prepared to react to. That is not something
I'm on one today, man. I'm sorry.
Is that Old Testament or New Testament?
Maybe it transcended eras. I forget where exactly it came from.
Yeah, is that the same as a shilling? I think that's what Judas was paid to betray Jesus, if I'm not mistaken.
I think you're right. I think shilling is more like a, you know, like what Ebenezer Scrooge would like, you know, throw down to the peasants on the street and you know.
All right, so we're going Oregon over Utah, Baylor, Oklahoma State. I'm sticking with Oklahoma State here, and I'm gonna. I think it's a competitive game, but I think Oklahoma State covers the 5.5.
I think so too. I just don't think that Baylor is going to be able to score enough to stay inside this number.
Okay. Georgia, Alabama. You may have heard of these teams. They play in the SEC. Georgia, 6.5-point favorites. We're both picking the dogs. I'm going to put that out there. Are we taking the dogs to cover the 6.5?
Final score prediction, Georgia 27, Alabama 17.
Okay. Georgia covers. Could find somewhere where you could submit a perfect, you know, final score bet. By all means, there it is.
But even if you can't, you still know my lean on that one. It's Georgia in the under.
Okay. Okay. I like it a lot. That's Georgia with the points, minus 6.5 again. Technically the road team, according to how this is listed. Houston, Cincinnati again, 10.5 point favorites here.
It's tricky because I do respect Houston a lot, but I think this is Cincinnati's moment. I think they cover.
I think Cincinnati wins. I think they make it more difficult than it needs to be. It is a massive moment. I mean, this is the most pressure that they're going to have in any game this season, including the Notre Dame game. I think, you know, we've seen them look a little iffy. They've looked, you know, they've looked a little more dominant. I think more like the team we hope to see these last few weeks, beating down some lesser opponents. But I mean, like you said, Houston's won 11 in a row. This is a good team. This is an 11-1 Houston Cougars outfit. I think Cincinnati wins the game. I don't think they win it by at least 11 points. So I think we get something like a 31-26 type of game.
Okay, I like that. I think either way, we're in for an exciting, very entertaining game. But I think that totally makes sense to go with Houston with that many points. But this would be a bet suggesting that Cincinnati plays its best game to kind of make its last case to the committee.
I think that's the most fun scenario. Like Cincinnati winning in a romp and you know, really kind of building some momentum going into the playoff would be fun. But I don't think the talent gap is that huge between these teams. And I think there is a ton of pressure on Cincinnati to win this game. And I think that gets to them early on. All right, in the Big Ten, Michigan, Iowa, Michigan 11-point favorites against the Hawkeyes.
That's a tight one again. And it's not a lot of scoring that's going to be had in this one. You know, an implied over under here of 43.5. I'll still go Michigan though. I just think that the defense kind of similar to the OK State Baylor, but in a different way. Defense kind of carries Michigan, keeps Iowa off the scoreboard enough to where, you know, it's like a 13-point victory for Michigan.
Yeah, I know I said I don't think it's going to be easy for Michigan, but I still think the final score is going to reflect a somewhat comfortable win. I will take Michigan to cover as well. I think we maybe get a close game early on. And like you said, I just trust this Michigan defense. I don't know that the Michigan offense is going to run rampant all over Iowa, but I'm really confident that the Michigan defense is going to be able to shut down what the Hawkeyes are bringing on their end.
Yeah, I mean, Iowa got completely bailed out by Nebraska, just Nebraskaing that last week. I don't think that they get that same sort of lifeline this time around against Michigan.
All right, Pitt, Wake Forest. What do we got here? We got Pitt.
I think Pitt, 3-point Pitt wins this one convincingly. Okay. I've been burned by fading Wake Forest many a time this year, but I got to stay true to my brand. But no, it objectively, I do think that Pitt is the better team. I think they win this one by closer to a touchdown.
All right, we're doing a bonus pick heading into the weekend. Jacksonville Jaguars, 13-point dogs on the road at the LA Rams.
I'm taking the points. Right, correct. The Rams have just found a way to like completely erode all of the public faith that they built up in September.
I'm with you on that. I can't believe I'm back in the Jags here. I think there's definitely the potential for like a massive correction here. And it's like Rams 48, Jags 3. Like that is in the cards. That's always in the cards.
Of course.
When the Jags are playing. But the Rams were also like 2 50-plus-yard bombs away from getting completely housed at Lambeau on Sunday.
See, exactly. So yeah, this Rams team, they're in a weird kind of identity crisis spot right now. And I think that the Jags can just, you know, they don't have to keep it that close to cover the spread.
They just got to play their game.
They play their game, play Jags football. And exactly. Then one last little thing I'll leave you with since we're talking our own teams that we like. There's an establishment up the street from me that I go to for trivia on Thursday nights. I love the place, but it is also an Alabama and Steelers bar. And
no.
We have Georgia playing the Georgia playing Bama this weekend and the Ravens playing the Steelers on Sunday afternoon. So I might like stumble in there Sunday night and not make it out alive.
You definitely can't go there tonight. Do not. Like that would be just a horrible voodoo type of situation. I don't think you can step foot in there tonight.
We think so? All right. I might have to change my plans.
It's a little too coincidental, right? That Baltimore is playing Pittsburgh and Georgia has Bama. If it was one or the other, you know, I think you could pull it off. It's just too risky.
It's okay. Now I got some. Now I got some doubts about my plans for the Thursday evening. I think I certainly appreciate your advice as my advisor on this type of thing, especially when it comes to vibes. So
yep,
I'm in a tough pickle here.
Yeah, you know, think about it. Take some time, but just consider the implications of what could happen. You know, if things go awry this weekend, I will be watching the Milwaukee Bucks play the Toronto Raptors in a little bit here. You have some more prep to do for the weekend. Obviously, a lot going on still in the college football world. Jonathan, enjoyed breaking it down with you. As always, we will be back for the recap on Monday.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.